It should come as no surprise to find that productive writers also read a lot, and they're often quite generous in sharing their thoughts on the work of other writers. Jonathan Lethem provides that generosity in a new volume of short works called More Alive and Less Lonely. Jonathan Lethem is a fiction writer and essayist. His 10 novels include the recent A Gambler's Anatomy and Dissident Gardens, among others. Motherless Brooklyn won a National Book Critics Circle Award, and his earlier essay collection, The Ecstasy of Influence, was a finalist for an NBCC Award. And he's been a MacArthur Fellow, and his shorter work has appeared in The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, and many more publications. This essay collection was edited by Christopher Boucher. Jonathan Lethem, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you. It's really nice to be here.
I read that you spent many of your formative years at protests, so it seemed entirely appropriate that the photo we used on the website was of you at Occupy Wall Street. Have you ever counted up the days, weeks, months you've spent at protests?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know I don't know what the total would be, but I do know it was a sort of formative site for me. I mean, I don't really even remember what my first protest was, because I was dragged along as a child to a number of Vietnam War demonstrations and took it as a given that, you know, this was sort of like a way of life for my family, that we would be, you know, gathering our forces and, you know, getting on a bus down to Washington, D.C. or you know, later in the 80s, I was very active in the now probably completely forgotten Helen Caldicott era of anti-nuke protests.
Oh, yeah, the no nukes, sure, yeah.
I was all over the place for that. As a teenager, that was when I began going on my own steam, you know, to the Shoreham power plant on Long Island.
Oh, the nuclear plant, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And, you know, so this was just something I saw as, you know, part of being alive, actually.
So how closely did Dissident Gardens, for example, come to your own life or that of your parents?
Well, you know, both that novel and an earlier one called The Fortress of Solitude use a lot of autobiographical material, but they use it kind of obliquely, or they smash it together with other things, with outright fiction and with other people's life stories that I've learned or things I learned from reading memoirs. You know, in the case of Dissident Gardens, it's really about a kind of a second generation red diaper baby, and the character who is more or less generationally equivalent to me, well, he has it a lot rougher than I do in terms of his estrangement from his family and also his estrangement from his own political origins. I'm much more, you know, I guess you'd say kind of situated or in accord with where I came from. This guy, the grandson in this family, is completely lost. But some of the details, some of the life story of the grandmother and the mother in that book, come directly from my own mother and grandmother. But, you know, there were things I didn't know and I had to make up or postulate by researching.
When you said red diaper baby, is that a child who grows up in a socialist household?
Yes, right, exactly. You know, my grandmother, I never knew, because it was sort of covered in silence and self-reproach by the time I came along. I never knew exactly what the extent of her communist participation in the 1930s. But I think it was pretty sincere and pretty extensive. And certainly she had a track record of, you know, being what they called back then a premature anti-fascist, which was to march against Hitler before we were officially supposed to be doing that. So you know, and she would show me these clippings from Life magazine of her at a famous kind of riot on the Upper East Side, marching against a German-American celebration of Hitler's birthday. So she was a real leftist, and then, like a lot of those, by the time of the 1950s, after the Stalin purges had been revealed and, you know, the Soviet Union had been discredited as an ideal in anyone's eyes, short of a, you know, really delusional person, she was sort of, you know, she'd sort of covered up that part of her life. Not in regret, she hadn't become right wing. Instead, she'd become just a kind of political, you know, ingrate. She was unhappy with everything, and it had all gone bad. The 20th century had betrayed her ideals.
Oh, sure,
And it was that dark, conflicted legacy that I wanted to write about in that book.
Activism was not the only thing in your young life. I mean, what are the other kinds of things propelled you to write?
Well, I mean, my parents were really in the world of the arts. And, you know, I mean, for shorthand, you could say my dad was, and what he is, he's still alive, a beatnik painter. He was a 1950s era college student, and he went to Paris to learn to paint. And my mother was 10 years younger than he was, and it was a real child of the 60s. And our house was full of art and books and music, and also it was a, you know, semi-communal household. So it was really full also of these other adults who were my dad's painting students or activists or just, you know, kind of the fun, freaky, kitchen table full of friends that would come over and hang out with them. And I was absorbing all of this stuff. I mean, the milieu of my parents' lives was tremendously interesting to me, and I gained a lot of what I still care about, really, from just listening, sitting there as a kid and absorbing, what these artists and radicals were talking about and what they cared about.
I can't wait to ask about the possibility of a teenage rebellion and what that might have looked like, but we have to go to a break. We're talking to Jonathan Lethem about a collection of his works assembled by the editor Christopher Boucher. It is called More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers. Jonathan Lethem's thoughts on other writers after we're getting to know him a little better. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We'll come back and talk more with Jonathan and take some of your thoughts as well. And then we'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Jonathan Lethem, who has made a lot of waves with his novels over the years, his last five, and there's a bunch, Gambler's Anatomy, Dissident Gardens, Chronic City, You Don't Love Me Yet, and The Fortress of Solitude. But we're talking less about the novels than his writing about other writers, as contained in a new work called More Alive and Less Lonely. It's Jonathan Lethem's writings on books and writers. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we just established the growing up years for you with parents who were activists and into everything, books, music, lots of stuff around the house, just people who thought a lot. So was there any kind of a teenage rebellion for you against all that?
Well, you know, I it was interesting. I did have that challenge of carving out my own version of, you know, what it was to be cool in opposition to my parents. And it was tricky because they had, you know, frankly, they had like a great record collection. but I was also very lucky because punk rock came along at exactly the right moment.
Oh, perfect.
You know, I was born in 1964. So I was basically, you know, when I needed it, I was, you know, 14, 15. Suddenly there was this other form of expression, which was, you know, to cut my hair really short and buy a motorcycle jacket, even though I lived in New York City, and go to CBGB and go to the Mud Club and listen to music that sounded bad to them. It was too fast and too loud and too snotty, and so that was my salvation.
Christopher Boucher, the editor of this work, describes you as one of the brightest stars in his literary solar system. Did he get his admiration under control for the project?
Well, you know, he did. Chris did a marvelous job with this, and there really wouldn't be a book because I don't think I could have gone through the enormous pile of my the reviews and introductions and made this kind of sense of it. So I'm grateful to him for his affectionate devotion to this work because he really organized the book and you know, he found the title and he made sense of it by creating the sections and the different, you know, kinds of emphasis inside the book. He really made something that was just an unruly mass of of outtakes or of, you know, journalism into something that I think does stand up as a book.
What does the title mean, More Alive and Less Lonely?
Well, he found that phrase in a account. You know, one of the things this book includes, along with reviews and introductions, are a few longer anecdotes about my relationship to other writers. In the case of this one writer, Thomas Berger, I had a very long and kind of mysterious friendship with him. It was all conducted by mail and on the telephone. We never met in person. But beginning when I was a very young writer, I only published a couple of short stories, I would send my work to Berger, who I revered, and he began to, you know, kind of grace me with his attention, and he'd read my books, and we developed this very nice, reciprocal, collegial writer's friendship. And I was talking, I think, about how it felt to see a Thomas Berger letter in my mailbox, you know, and see that he, you know, used his, hauled out his electric again and typed my name, and, you know, it was very formal, Mr. Jonathan Lethem, and it, you know, it's, I would know, it would be on his personal stationery. And my heart would soar, and I just wrote in the book that I felt more alive and less lonely because Berger was out there. And I didn't think of it as the title of a book, but Chris, when he was editing it, was looking within the essays for a possible title, and he found this phrase, more alive and less lonely.
Well, you know, speaking of phrases and words in general, there's a couple of places in this collection where you remark upon the limitations of language. And as somebody who uses it and uses it well, I guess I found that a little surprising, but I began to think about that about 6 o'clock this morning on my walk. It's like, well, you know, we really don't have an ability to get exactly what we mean across, minus telepathy.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is something I think about all the time. The more you use it, the more, in a way, mysterious language becomes. I also think narrative itself is a kind of, you know, on a larger scale, is a mysterious language. The kind of storytelling, the kind of the urge to express ourselves, the urge to name our world, to point to things inside ourselves and out there that we can't quantify or reduce or precisely understand, but we want to give them a name and trap them in language. This is a really you know, seductive, you know, it's a thing I've devoted my life to, and it's very rich, but I do think it's inexact and sometimes slips away from you. You know, you find the properties of language can be quite unstable.
Jonathan Lethem is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His writing about other writers is contained in a volume called More Alive and Less Lonely, edited by Christopher Boucher. So let's jump into some of the material here. Up first is Eric Byrne and The Happy Valley, which you call the loneliest book I've read. Why lonely?
Well, I was asked to contribute to a collection of writers on books that were unexpected or, outré. And I was actually given that title, What's the Loneliest Book You've Ever Read? And I immediately thought of this children's book. You know, many people remember this guy, this author, Eric Byrne, for writing a kind of a famous book of popular psychology called Games People Play. It was in the 60s and into the 70s. It was one of those books like a Malcolm Gladwell, you know, or it had really saturated the mm-hmm. popular imagination. And there were even a couple of pop songs that were given that title because of the book, Games People Play. But the same author wrote a children's book at the height of his popularity. I mean, it's the kind of thing you do, right? Like Sylvester Stallone wrote a children's book, Madonna wrote a children's book. It's kind of what you do if you're so famous that you can do anything, is you write a kid's book. So when Games People Play was on the bestseller list, he wrote this very eccentric children's book called The Happy Valley. And frankly, it's really kind of a paisley-colored, psychedelic voyage. It's like a kind of Phantom Tollbooth or Alice in Wonderland. A child goes into a strange world and explores it and meets, you know, talking animals and so forth, but with a really hallucinogenic, almost kind of, you know, hippy-dippy vibe to it. And I loved this book. And I read it over and over and again as a kid, and it really helped form my sensibility. I can still, you know, quote bits of it. Mm-hmm. But I've never met another person who knows it.
Really? Not a single one?
It just exists in this total vacuum. I mean, you barely ever see copies, even if you go looking for them in used bookstores. It's almost as though there was only one copy made, and it was the one that I had.
But it's interesting, though, because in your references to this book, you mentioned things that I hadn't heard from another human being in 45 years, the cereal box characters Quisp and Quake.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we're getting old.
Oh, we are indeed.
Like, yeah, we're just getting old.
I love the postscript to this story about the Happy Valley, though, which is that the essay you wrote about it prompted a letter from France. And who was that from?
Well, so part of the magic of the book was that it was very beautifully illustrated. These eccentric, full-color illustrations, very complicated, not your typical children's book illustrations. And the illustrator's name was unknown to me, and I'd never seen it anywhere else. And I didn't really think twice about it. But she was a painter from France, and she had never illustrated another children's book after that. That wasn't what she did. She was a painter. But when I guess she was, you know, doing what we all succumb to every once in a while, Googling our own names, right? So my essay popped up on her. There she is in Paris in her studio, her painting studio, some 40-odd years after doing the illustrations for this forgotten children's book. And she sees her name in my essay and got in touch with me. You know, that's one of the things we can be grateful for the internet, is that people find each other in the most uncanny ways. And so she was able to reach out to me, and I ended up visiting her in Paris, and she met my children. It's some sort of like bizarre, full circle kind of existence. And her name is Sylvie Selig. I have a painting by her that hangs in my office right here.
Oh,
actually, looking at it as we speak.
Wow! So a great closed circle with the Happy Valley. We're talking to Jonathan Leatham here on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the author of many books. He is the Roy Disney Chair in Creative Writing at Pomona College in California, and he is the author of several different works collected under one cover called "More Alive and Less Lonely" on Books and Writers. It's reviews and introductions by Jonathan Leatham of other people's work. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, Moby Dick. We have to talk about Moby Dick and try not to spend the whole show on it. But I love the story about you encountering a bookshelf full of Moby Dicks.
Yeah, it still seems like a dream I had once. But I went to a party. My friend Kent Matricardi and I, he was invited to some party at a downtown loft in Manhattan. And this was an era where we were both single guys in Manhattan enjoying our lives, and we would go to party at the drop of a hat. I have no idea whose house this was, but we walked in, and I have a terrible weakness for going and examining other people's bookshelves. I always want to do it. So I saw a very big bookshelf, and I was excited. You know, the more books there are, usually the more interesting it's going to be. And I got closer and closer, and then it was like some sort of mind-bending drug I'd taken, because every book on the shelf was a different copy or edition of Moby Dick. The entire, this enormous wall was absolutely 100% old copies of Moby Dick, some of them very beaten up, some of them old paperbacks, every form, every format you can imagine. And it was just someone's testament to this, their commitment to this book. And it was a kind of an art installation and a statement. And it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
But your general sense of Moby Dick as conveyed to us is that it's almost too enormous to comprehend. It's like standing next to a glacier. You have to keep getting back and back and back.
Yeah. I mean, which is one of the best things a book can be, right, is a conundrum, something that you can never finish, you can never exhaust thinking about or reading. And, you know, I think, for me, as I've aged as a reader, I realize I'm always in search of that sense of being completely overwhelmed or colonized or just, you know, broken in half by a book. Now, that used to be when I was younger. All I had to do was, as a 12-year-old, go to my parents' shelves and pick up pretty much anything, Fear of Flying or a Graham Greene novel, and my mind would be blown. Well, as I've become a more savvy reader and I've encompassed more understanding and I'm a worldlier person, it's really these titanic masterworks that offer me that same feeling of being humbled at the feet of something. And so I like searching out these books that make you feel like, the way the monkeys are in 2001 when they touch the monolith. that you, you know, you just, the minute you make contact with it, your brain is bigger than it was a minute before.
From Moby Dick to Franz Kafka, does it seem like everyone has to agree with, or has to disagree, rather, with somebody else's characterization of Kafka?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like iconic characters that, you know, create this excessive level of identification in their fans. I mean, you could probably say the same thing of Bob Dylan, or you know, that, or, you know, in a way, if you look at the history of Shakespeare scholarship, what is it but a series of attempts to possess the object, right? And I think Kafka inspires a lot of this devotional but also proprietary love in people. It's like, he's not your Kafka, he's my Kafka. Only I get it. I'm the one. He was talking to me.
Which then probably inspires a few people to say, no, you're wrong. That is not what Kafka is.
Yeah.
So Kafka, as you point out, had trouble finishing his work. What do his diaries say about that?
Well, I mean, Kafka he's one of these writers who, in a sense, is defined simultaneously by the scarcity of his work, by having published very little, and, you know, if he'd had his way, I guess he left instructions to burn the unpublished writings, we would have very, very little evidence that he'd ever written. But on the other hand, he was obviously a graphomaniac. He was writing constantly. I mean, the books of letters and the diaries and the versions of different chapters in the castle. There's so much material.
That's amazing stuff. I want to point out, though, that there's a broad range of things, and we're not just going to be talking about Moby Dick and Kafka here, because Batman gets a moment in here as a creature worthy of Kafka. What do you mean by that?
Well, Batman was one of my first loves. You know, Batman comic books. I had a few tattered old copies, and I fell into this sort of trance. I think one of the things that interests me about comic books in general is that they're hard to get right. There's sort of no story about Batman that's as good as the idea of Batman that we all hold in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
The image, the iconography, you know, it's sort of like we're in search of a Batman story that's worthy of the idea that Batman himself kind of arouses in our brains. And so I had this idea that, you know, Franz Kafka should write about Batman. that kind of depth, that kind of painstaking self-examination would have been the only account of what Batman was really like that would be a persuasive one.
You riff for a while in More Alive and Less Lonely on Adam West's Batman, which kind of gets us into a general 60s track here, where I have to relate that yours and mine are very, very similar. I'm from Long Island myself originally,
uh-huh.
And we're both Mets fans. In fact, Maury Allen's The Incredible Mets is one of the first books I ever owned.
Well, you know, today is a good day because they won last night. I live or die by the Mets. It's really a pathetic existence, but it's the truth.
And we had 4 days of dying before last night, but
yeah,
let's not go into
yep.
that. So you did co-write a book called The Believeniks about the Mets, but under a pseudonym. Why?
Well, that book was conceived as a kind of, it's collaborative, first of all, with my old friend, my high school friend, a brilliant novelist named Christopher Sorrentino. And he's another Mets fan. But that book is really, it's really a novel about Mets fans as it is a book about the Mets. Because the two fictional authors that we made up, the two pseudonyms we used, are themselves characters. And it was really about what it is to be an obsessed person and to care about something that doesn't care about you in return.
You mean the Mets don't know?
The Mets have no idea that, you know, that I'm wasting all this love on them. It's almost like a religious situation.
Let's move on to Dickens and Dombey and Son. And I just, you suggest that people read this as if it were a book about fuzzy animals.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing about, so a lot of the introductions in this book are me introducing an obscure or out-of-print book, you know, something like Eric Burns' children's book, right?
Right.
But it's a very different situation when you're asked to be the introducer for a absolutely canonical writer like Dickens. I mean, first of all, it's an honor. It's really cool. But you also, what you're being brought in to do, by definition, is, as a younger writer, to say why Dickens is still important or accessible or available, you know, or fun for a modern reader to pick up. Because the problem that, you know, the publisher who's publishing Dickens has is that people think it's kind of wheezy and you know, yes, of course, it's important and we all know the name Dickens, but who would want to read that now?
Huh.
And there's a sense of, you know, these are very long novels, that they're intimidating, that they're kind of, they've been a little bit, you know, they're like sealed up in amber. And what you want to do is break the amber and make them available and fresh and something that people could just have a direct reading experience with that isn't, you know, like some sort of obligation or a school assignment. And one of the things about Dickens is his books are so warm. They're just bursting with humanity and character and color. And I said, if you think of these characters as like being like Wind in the Willows, think of them as animals, then you'll see just how Dickens wanted you to, how he intended you to experience them.
Wow, that is fun. We have much more to talk about with Jonathan Leatham. His collection of introductions and reviews of other writers' work is called More Alive and Less Lonely, collected by the editor Christopher Boucher. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Jonathan Leatham, and you can join us by phone or by email in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking with Jonathan Leatham, who has written so many books. His novels include Gun with Occasional Music, Amnesia Moon, As She Climbed Across the Table, Girl in Landscape, and Motherless Brooklyn. That's just about half of his list. He is a very prolific writer, currently ensconced at Pomona College in California as the Roy Disney Chair in Creative Writing. And his writing about other writers, his introductions to books and his reviews of other writers' work, is contained in a collection called More Alive and Less Lonely, Jonathan Leatham on Books and Writers, as assembled by the editor Christopher Boucher. You can visit with us here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So let's move on to some other authors here. Philip Roth, you point out that you walled yourself off from him early in life. Why?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I was aware of the big novelists of the day, you know, and that was names that we remember and still revere, like, you know, John Updike and Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, you know, and there were some others who were, you know, kind of, who were kind of forgotten, who were the seemed to clog up the book pages. But I was much more interested in what I thought of as kind of subterranean literature. I was into the Beats, and I was into science fiction, and I you know, I wanted things that were published by New Directions and Grove Press. And I dismissed Roth as in some way kind of too obvious or corny or mainstream for my interest before I ever really even dabbled in it. And of course, he's not that. He's a really, really distinct iconoclastic and, you know, and very, very angry, crazy, unforgettable voice when you encounter him. So it took me a while to come around and sort of reframe him as someone who was relevant to my writing. But then when I did get him in view, he seemed like the only thing I could read. You know, there was like a couple of years where I just went back and devotionally read everything. And his voice is, you know, you get kind of drunk on it.
Well, people seem to report him as both delightful and confounding at the same time. And there's a great story in here about a student you knew who was writing a thesis on Roth and ultimately quit the project. Why?
You know, he was a wonderful student. He'd fallen in love with Roth's voice. And I think that he was finding that trying to write about Roth was impossible because Roth had encircled the critic. You know, he'd already anticipated anything you might say about him. And so he just threw up his hands and said, I can't do this thesis. I'm going to graduate on other terms. And he did.
Have there been times, I mean, you write so freely about other people's work. I wonder if there's anybody who was truly daunting to you.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. There are people who I read with great interest who I haven't figured out or been given the right occasion to write about. You know, Christina Stead the woman who wrote The Man Who Loved Children. And that's one of the books of my life. It's just an awesome kind of, I mean, I was talking about earlier about books that you can never finish, you can never exhaust, you can never completely resolve your experience with them. And that's one of those books for me. But I've never found a way to say more than, well, just what I did, which is to say that Christina Stead matters to me. But I've never written about her writing, for instance. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that can be true.
Philip Roth, we just talked about. Philip K. Dick, what drew you to his work?
Well, he's one of my, you know, early idols and a kind of totemic writer for me. I discovered his science fiction novels when I was 15 or 16 years old, and I mean, talk about going on a binge. There's nothing I wanted to read for a couple of years, and you know, my first attempts to write fiction were shameless imitations of Philip Dick. I really modeled. I thought I was going to just do my best to extend his style, you know, in my own writing. And my first few books show that, you know, for better or worse, they show that influence enormously. I later incorporated other influences, and you know, I guess you could say my own voice amalgamated in different ways. So the presence of his influence is a little more sublimated in my work now. But I think about him all the time. He matters to me enormously.
So if you just read the science fiction works of Philip K. Dick, you're missing a lot.
Well, I think his greatest novels are nominally science fiction. They have fantastic elements. They're mostly written in the 60s in two great bursts. He was very prolific and astoundingly good, you know, between like 1963 and 65. That's, you know, in that short period he writes The Man in the High Castle and Martian Timeslip and The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. And then there's another burst in the late 60s when he writes Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And that's the book that became Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. And Ubik. And those are, you know, those are his towering works. There's another phase, a really interesting, strange phase, in the 70s where he writes things based on his own visionary religious insights. And there are a couple of novels in that period that I think are terrific, too. Valis and The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. But none of these are, you would say, kind of normative or realist works. He did try to write realist novels a few different times, and there's some good ones. But his greatest works are, however you want to categorize them, surrealism, works of the uncanny, or science fiction. They contain these disruptions, reality disruptions in them.
You know, I didn't get far enough into the book to see if you got any Vonnegut in here, and I wondered if how he appeals to you, if it's any kind of a level similar to Philip K. Dick.
That's an interesting question. Vonnegut really enraptured me when I first discovered his work, also around age 14, 15, 16, and I voraciously went through all the books at the time. He's someone who hasn't sustained for me. I haven't circled back with success and found the same nourishment there that I did when I was younger and first discovering him. But that's, you know, there are writers who are associated with a period in your life. I would say the same thing about Jack Kerouac, who, you know, seemed absolutely urgent to me when I was, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. I don't go back there with a lot of success. I don't see the same thing I saw, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't crucial to me. It just, you know, Hermann Hesse, I think Ray Bradbury, I would say the same thing about, that they're associated with like a period in my reading experience.
And kind of stuck there?
Yeah.
I want to come back to Philip Dick for just a second and ask about the cinematic treatments and whether you've seen them or care about them and whether you think they were faithful, like Blade Runner and the more recent TV version of The Man in the High Castle.
Well, I mostly find myself with resistance. You know, Blade Runner is a remarkable film. It's a really important film to me and I think, you know, to a lot of people. But its relationship to its source is kind of oblique. It's not a direct, you know, faithful, dutiful adaptation of that novel. And one of the interesting things about Philip K. Dick, as he's been handled in Hollywood or in other media, is that they've, to a large extent, they've stayed away from some of his greatest novels and adapted short stories or smaller works into films. The Man in High Castle is an exception. That is based on one of his, you know, key writings, his key novels. And I guess I think it's about half good, and the half that's good is the premise. You know, it's such a great idea. It's so extraordinary to think about that you can watch the show and be pretty excited, but what you're being excited about is what Philip K. Dick invented and I think still did a much better job of handling in his own novel than they do in the show.
We have an email here from Jeff, I believe, from Ashland. He says, I'm really enjoying this interview, having experienced a lot of the same anti-nuke protests, etc., but the synchronicities just keep coming. I just opened Moby Dick for the first time, and I'm amazed at how incredibly enjoyable and fresh the writing is. And I'm curious if Jonathan is a Cormac McCarthy fan. That's from Jeff in Ashland.
Well, I mean, first of all, that's a great association you're making there, because I think, you know, I mean, Melville inspired so many different writers, and a lot of people who love Cormac McCarthy can identify the kind of the biblical, the Old Testament elements in his language, but probably he was also, you know, and also the Faulkner elements. It's really obvious that Cormac McCarthy dug Faulkner, right? But the fact that he also is obviously a Melville guy, I think it's a really, really smart leap that you've just made there. I like Melville more than I like McCarthy personally, because some of the kind of, I don't know, Gothic, Faulkner, murky Christian stuff doesn't really do it for me. I find Melville amazing because he's so he himself is so interested in biblical language. I mean, a lot of his dialect or vernacular comes from biblical language, but I, you know, I think a key to Moby Dick as well is that he's reading a lot of Shakespeare. Huh. Melville was reading King Lear, and you know, you find chunks of Shakespeare that are just deposited in the thick of his prose. So, but I'm really glad you're having that experience with it.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for that. Is there one writer above all others whose work you do like, but who is something of a mystery to you? You just can't quite figure out where they're coming from.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I mean, I just glossed over Faulkner in mm-hmm. in that last ramble I gave you. Faulkner, you know, every now and then he comes into focus, and I think, oh my God, this is why have I not devoted my life to this guy? This is the writer for me. And then other times it's like a wall shutting down. I just don't understand why he's making it difficult the way he's making it difficult, and I resist it completely. I don't find it very easy to identify with him, but there are flashes for me of thinking that, you know, that is the great American body of work that I haven't, like, you know, gotten my brain around. So maybe he's a mystery to me that way. I mean, there are others that I just haven't even really approached, who I suspect I would care for. You know, there's some, the thing about the world of fiction is it's bottomless. There's so much
Truly.
That's so great. And, I just always think, to be reductive or to say there's, oh, you know, it's all about this guy or it's all about this book or is ridiculous, because actually it's a giant interconnected network of nodes of interest. And, you know, they all light up for you at different times if you let them, if you aren't reductive about it.
Let's come to a fairly recent book, and this is in current affairs, prisons in this case. Your intro to Malcolm Brayley's On the Yard is here. Why? What did you find so good about that?
Oh, it's such a special book, and he's such a special, strange career. So, you know, he was an incarcerated writer. He was in San Quentin, and it's an interesting story because he was there at a time when there were a number of prison writers at San Quentin at the same time. And he actually got his agent because another writer who was publishing while in prison at San Quentin introduced Brawley to his agent in the visiting room. And initially, Brawley was a crime writer. He wrote a couple of very good, tight, you know, Pacific Northwest-based crime stories that were published in paperback originals by Gold Medal Books, and then he wrote this one, I think, really the best, for my money, the best novel of prison in American literature, certainly the best one written from the inside, called On the Yard. And I had the luck to be introduced to this book by the New York Review of Books, who were bringing it back into print and asked me to be the introducer. And that's it's just a novel that holds up. Brawley is a very poignant figure because he earned his freedom and he was enjoying his celebrity, and then he died in a car accident. So his time in the sun after, you know, kind of pulling himself out of the prison world was very brief.
About a minute left to ask a final question, and I guess it should have to be about working in fiction as you do and being a former activist as you were, or maybe you still are. I'd wonder what you make of the alternative facts world we seem to be living in at the moment.
Well, you know, yeah, that's a big question to drop at the
at the very end
with the clock ticking. But, you know, I think that literature, maybe especially certain particular kinds of literature, can really be a bit of a flare in this darkness, a way of connecting with other people and with ourselves, because it's such an unreal situation. You know, there's been such a disintegration in the kind of the system of what do you call it, this civic
sort of standard connection of things we understand.
Yeah, the ways in which we understand one another and ourselves and our relation to society is disintegrated, and so we need to locate these, you know, these beacons. You know, dystopian literature in particular, I think, can be really useful right now.
Okay. Jonathan Lethem has written many books. A Gambler's Anatomy is his most recent novel. Dissident Gardens, Motherless Brooklyn, you name it. He's written a lot of stuff. His writing on other writers is collected in the edition called More Alive and Less Lonely, Jonathan Lethem on Books and Writers, as compiled by the editor Christopher Boucher. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was a gas. Thanks so much.
All right, take care.